This is class number 2 of the North Battleford Ecclesia March 2017 study weekend. The general theme of the series is God's Wisdom in the Family Design. The title for this class is The Wisdom of the Family Unit. Our opening reading was Psalm 127. We now call on Brother Ken to lead us in this class. Brother Ken.
Okay, someone from the back two rows. If Christ doesn't return in the next 5 years, approximately how many classes would everyone in this room listen to, God willing? 1,125 classes, which means take 30 seconds, reflect upon what we talked about in the first class, and just tell the person next to you what you found to be a significant point. You can do it privately. If you have no one sitting next to you, then you'll have to have a conversation with yourself. But we had this conversation with the young people only because we need to get in the habit of hearing Bible principles and having them stick so that they can then impact how we walk, so it can impact how we live. It's very, very easy to hear and forget. We likened it to, if we fail to recall these principles, it's like each day God has to take, you know how you get a new computer and you turn the computer on and you go through this 3-hour process of loading programs and getting it up to ready, you know, getting ready to use, and finally you come down to the kitchen and say, oh, got that new computer all ready, now I can use it. Imagine if God had to reboot us every day because we just didn't listen to what he was telling us on one day to remember it to the next. So, going the wrong way. Just to review quickly from the first class, our aim in this series is to understand how God designed the marriage relationship and the family unit so we can learn to cooperate with it. Marriage is a total commitment and devotion to God and to each other. Our spouse is God's special gift to us. It is who we need. God is responsible for bringing us together, knowing our respective strengths and weaknesses, and we need to treat them as such. That's in red because I forgot to turn it back to black, so it's not that that's more important than any others. But I should make a point that Brother Skip was helpful in clarifying this for me, and I should have made the point that, you know, we have to operate within God's principles. So, young fellas, you can't go out, as we were talking last night, and find a Jezebel for a wife, and then say, well, God, you're supposed to make it work out, because she's your gift to me. If we deviate from God's principles, and if we decide to marry out of the truth, or we violate any of the other principles that God has left on record, we can't turn around and expect God to, you know, be able to bless that situation as he has promised to do if we operate within his principles. That's not to say he can't help us recover from those circumstances. But I don't want any of us to presume upon God's grace by saying, well, you've promised to take care of me, so I'm just going to jump off this cliff and hope that you save me. Well, we have to be real clear on that situation. God designed the marriage relationship to be unique and to create a special affinity or an intimacy between the couple. We looked at 10 different aspects. That's not accidental. God designed this so that we would see this is a very special person in my life. I share things with this person that I share with no other. God, that's exactly how God wants the relationship to be. He uses the marriage relationship to expose our sins so they can be properly dealt with. It's an ideal environment to transform saints. As the head, the husband is responsible to save his wife. God aligns his salvation, the salvation of the husband, with the husband's need to learn to live like Christ. We didn't really get to the last two points, so we'll pick those up now. Just a couple of quick points to finish up with our from the first class. Okay, when it comes to the wives then, we don't want to leave the wives out of the discussion. You'll see in the notes there's a couple of entries there. They are, as we said in the first class, to submit to their own husbands because that too is a divine principle. Ephesians 5, verse 22 says, wives should be subject to their husbands in everything. It's repeated in Colossians 3 and again in 1 Peter 3. Likewise, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands. The world says this is foolish and archaic, and it leaves a wife with an unfulfilled life. But as we saw in the first class, in God's wisdom, this divine command places a tremendous responsibility on the husband's shoulders. So, young ladies, if your aim in life is to be part of God's future, and hopefully it is, then obeying this command should not be seen as something that is archaic or something that is outdated. It's in God's wisdom that you place yourself in a relationship with a young man whose responsibility is to save you. And that's why, as we mentioned last night, it's critical that you find a young man who understands God's principles about a marriage relationship. And we've reached the stage now where it's no longer just good enough to find a young man in the truth. We need to find young brethren who are devoting themselves to a godly life. And it works the same way. A young man needs to find a young woman who is also making the same kind of commitment. We've included in the notes the fact that men in general today have grossly abused their responsibility as husbands, but that does not alter the divine principle of submission. It takes great faith on the part of the wife, but again, this is something where God asks the wife to obey by faith. Nothing that God asks us to do in terms of giving us commands are we to obey in the strength of our own flesh. Every time there is submission in Scripture, we submit by faith. In the ecclesia, we submit to the elders of the ecclesia by faith, not because they are the smartest brethren. And I don't mean to demean the brethren in any way, but God doesn't say make submission to anyone a function of their capacity or their ability or their intelligence. He says submit in these relationships by faith. Trust me that if you will submit as I have commanded to. So slaves were to submit to their masters by faith, not just if the master happened to be a good person. And of course, the supreme case of this probably in Scripture is when Sarah submitted herself to Abraham and called him Lord in 1 Peter 3, even though on more than one occasion, Abraham put Sarah in a very compromising situation. And yet that did not alter her regard or her respect for Abraham because her faith was in God. And there's really only one way wives can submit to their husbands, and that's by showing godly love based on faith in God. They're certainly not putting their faith in the husband because as all husbands know, wives will invariably let down their wives. But by placing her faith in God, not her husband, she trusts God will bless her and will not put her in a situation beyond what she can bear, as he has promised, that all will work out for her eternal well-being. We just had one comment about communication before we move on to the family unit. So, I better smile up front so you know I'm not serious, but this is a graph of our marriage. Husbands, have you ever graphed your marriage? You take all the pieces, the spiritual piece, the emotional piece, the physical piece, all the pieces, and you put them together, and you can put them on a graph, and there is the graph of our marriage, tongue in cheek, okay? And there is a graph of the effective communication in our marriage since we were married back in 1977. Do you need to see the other graph again? Or no? You see, they're one and the same graph. As goes the communication in our marriage, so has gone our marriage. Now, just so nobody misunderstands, that doesn't really represent our marriage. But you get the idea. As communication goes in your marriage, the effectiveness of your marriage relationship goes up and down. The real beauty of this is that communication can improve immediately. You may have financial difficulties in your marriage that aren't going to change. You may have health issues in your marriage that aren't going to change. You may have other issues in your marriage that aren't going to change, at least not in the short term. You may have ecclesial issues in your marriage. You may have difficulties with your kids that aren't going to change. But communication can always, always improve. And you can do it immediately. You don't have to wait. It will oftentimes involve an apology. It will involve taking the time to have discussions that you need to have. But communication is an aspect of our marriage that doesn't take anything other than two people being committed to improving the communication. Very simple, yet very critical. And as soon as we improve the communication, the graph begins to go upward. Okay, so we should also point out that all of the principles we talked about in the first class regarding marriage, you know, those principles don't just apply to newlyweds. They don't just apply to people in the marriage 5 or 10 years. You know, with God's principles, we can always improve. And I'm hoping no one came today and said, well, I've been married for so long, I'm not going to change. You know, we're basically, we have the marriage relationship we're going to have till the kingdom comes. Because God is always looking for us to improve. So I would encourage now, as we're going to leave the marriage part behind and move on to the family unit, for the husbands and wives that are here today that are able to hear these things together, if your spouse is not involved in one of the classes with the kids, you know, have the conversations. Find time this week to take 30 minutes over a cup of coffee or a cup of tea or at a coffee shop or whatever it is. Find time and just discuss, share with each other what you got out of the marriage portion of the classes. And I think you'll find it beneficial. All God really needs is for us to bring a desire to our relationship to do better and a humbleness in which we acknowledge that I am not the best husband I could be, or we don't have the optimum marriage that we could have. And if we would make some changes, it could improve things for ourselves and everyone else impacted by our marriage. But he needs that humble outlook in order to be able to bless that situation. Okay, so we move on then to class number two that we have called the wisdom of the family unit. And hopefully you're beginning to see why we call it the wisdom of the family unit, because you start with a marriage relationship in which, you know, and this is by God's design, there is a husband and a wife, a mother and father, who both love and fear God, and they both love and fear each other, they both love each other, and they are both committed to the salvation of each other. So that's what you start out with. Two people who love God, two people who love each other, and they're both committed to the salvation of one another. And into that environment, God places his children, so that those two people who love each other and who love God and are committed to helping save each other can now raise God's child to learn about God so that the child can grow up to embrace God's ways and be part of God's future. That is an ideal environment in which to raise children. When you have a husband and wife who love each other and are committed to one another's salvation and who love God, they will then raise that child to grow up to choose to make God their father. And you see, it isn't just the child who benefits, because that child is going to help save mom and dad. And that is not accidental. That is all how God has designed this. Because by mom and dad devoting themselves to the salvation of their children, and that's what it takes, they have to be devoted to the salvation of their children, God is able to save mom and dad. Because they have to stay on the straight and narrow. They cannot deviate from righteousness. You can't have one day we'll be in the world and one day we'll be with God. Not with children, not today. The parents have to stay on the road to life if that child is going to learn to grow up to embrace God. Otherwise, the children are left confused. If they hear mom and dad saying one thing and then they see them living something else. But in God's wisdom, if everyone will do their part, then everyone is encouraged unto righteousness. And everyone is encouraging each other unto righteousness. Not that sweet little Kara can encourage mom and dad unto righteousness today. But God willing, when she grows up, as all our children do, when they get to that age, they can encourage us unto righteousness. They can ask us those probing questions. They can make inquiry about why do we do this and why do we live this way and all those conversations we have with them. It isn't just us teaching them. It's God having us engaged in their salvation to make sure we remain true to what we're saying. And it's all designed to save all the people involved in that family unit. So that just as we saw with the marriage relationship, the family unit is the ideal place for God to save people. And it's how he achieves his purpose of filling the earth with his glory. He didn't just start out with the earth and say, boy, we don't have many people, so Adam and Eve, you better go and make some people so we can fill the earth, so we have some people here. You know, he designed it all so it would work the way he designed it. The fact that the world has taken and obliterated God's principles, set all that aside. This is God saying, I want to fill the earth with people who reflect my glory, and I'm going to create a marriage relationship, and then I'm going to create a family unit in which to raise my children to grow up to be part of that future and save mom and dad in the process. It's an astonishing, wise relationship and creation that God has put into place. So we need to be very, very, very careful when we go to the library and we take a book off the shelf that talks to us about parenting children, because most authors do not understand what God is trying to accomplish in our lives. I'm not saying you should never read them. Just be very careful and make sure their counsel aligns with what God is trying to do. He's trying to save us. He's trying to save the mom, he's trying to save the dad, and he's trying to save the children. And he has principles in his word that the mom needs to follow, and the dad needs to follow, and the children need to follow. And if they will, then he can transform all of them and save all of them. But the marriage and the family unit really is the optimum way to save people. And this is why we need to understand the wisdom behind it so that we can embrace it and fulfill our own responsibilities. As we saw with the marriage relationship, in the family unit, that is the ideal place for character flaws to come to the surface. It really is. Make the family the ideal place for the shortcomings and the sins and the flaws of your children to come to the surface, so they can be dealt with properly. And is it not the ideal place? Two people who love a child who's made a mistake, two people who are committed to that child's salvation, and the child makes a mistake. It doesn't matter if the child has shamed you if the mistake happened at the ecclesia or it happened in public. You know, both people are committed to the child's salvation. And so it should be a loving environment in which the child is corrected. And the child needs to be corrected. I don't want anyone to think that this means we just turn a blind eye. Remember, we got to follow God's principles, and in class 3, God willing, we'll get to the discipline and we'll get to the rod. But it should be an ideal place for our children's flaws to come to the surface. Ideal. Not because we turn a blind eye, but because we deal with it in such a way that we teach our children about right and wrong. We hold them accountable. But then we also teach them about confession, and we teach them about forgiveness. And along the way, we point out that mom and dad are making mistakes as well. So we want to make our family, you know, a place where it's okay to make mistakes, because there are going to be lots of mistakes. And the children learn from the mistakes. And the beauty of it as well, brethren and sisters, for those of us who are parents know, that the family unit is also where dad's mistakes oftentimes come to the surface in dealing with the children's mistakes. But again, it's an ideal place for all of this to come to the surface. Or if mom can make mistakes. So it's not just the kids who are making the mistakes within the family unit. The flaws of everyone are exposed. And you see the children, in seeing that mom and dad are making mistakes, are witnessing, depending on their age, that mom and dad are also in training to be immortal saints. And this is how we handle mistakes within the family. I'm not saying we always did it right. We didn't always do it right. And I'm not saying every time dad made a mistake in our house, myself being the dad was always first and foremost to admit to his mistake. But you see, when you make a mistake and the kids see it and you don't acknowledge it, now you got two mistakes. And there's your wife, rightfully so, saying, well, the children just saw you do something. And they need to know that that wasn't the right thing to do. So do you want to tell them? Or do you want me to tell them? Remember, special gift to us, brethren. Left to ourselves, we would just pretend it didn't happen, and it's minor anyways. But they hold us accountable, as they should. Because the children need to see that mom and dad can make mistakes too. And mistakes need to be dealt with because we're trying to live by God's principles. If we do our part, God can save us all. If we just see our role as to teach the kids about God, but we don't have to follow it ourselves, we make it very difficult. The other thing I think we need to recognize is that God doesn't need perfect parents to raise his children. He doesn't. He needs committed parents, parents who are committed to holiness and committed to righteousness, and putting the kingdom first in their life. But he doesn't need perfect parents. If he needed perfect parents, all his children would be born in the kingdom to be raised by perfect immortal parents. But that's not how he's designed his creation. What he needs are devoted parents who are themselves devoted to his ways and who are devoted to raising his children according to his ways. You see, God can use very, very imperfect parents to raise his children. Remember, he set this up. He determined that a husband and a wife who have their own failings, as husband and wife and as parents, they are going to be the ones to raise his children, all their failings notwithstanding. Because you see, God is masterful at working with people who have failings, provided they acknowledge their failings and they are willing to learn from their mistakes, and provided we keep striving to do our best. So we should never conclude that we are somehow terrible parents or failures as parents because of our imperfections. We need to remember, God chose us to be parents of his children. And along with that responsibility is a requirement that we live up to what our duties are and responsibilities as parents. Our children, who are God's children, were not born by accident. Not when God has known them from before the foundation of the world. Forget what you hear about the world and how they talk about children, about mistakes, all of that, that does not apply to God's children, whom he has known from before the foundation of the world and whom he is preparing to share eternity with him. There's a simple overriding principle that I think it's helpful to keep in mind. In some respects, it transcends all other principles. It's fairly simple, as most of God's principles are, but it can be very powerful. And that is, if I want to raise a godly seed, then I must myself be living a godly life. If I am committed to my children's salvation, if I am committed to raising a godly seed in my home, then first and foremost, I must be living a godly life. So what makes a good parent? It starts with being a good disciple, one who genuinely loves God and puts the kingdom first in our life. So the absolute best thing we can do for our kids, the absolute best thing, is not to buy them anything. It's not to send them anywhere. It's not to buy some big house. It's not to live in some special place. The absolute best thing we can do for our children is to genuinely and sincerely be living the truth. Doesn't mean we won't make mistakes, but they need to see that there is not a gap between what mom and dad say and what mom and dad are trying to do. Our children see through the gaps. Maybe not at 4 or 5. You can fool them probably at 4 or 5. But by the time they're 14 or 15, if they see mom and dad talk about the truth in one way, and they talk about God in one way, but then they turn around and see that mom and dad are living completely different, or even significantly different, or even marginally different when it comes to how they live, and they see that gap, terribly, terribly confusing for our children. Doesn't matter how many CYCs they get to. It doesn't matter how many Bible classes they get to. It doesn't matter how many Sunday school classes they attend. None of it will matter if they don't see that mom and dad's foremost desire is to faithfully serve God. So they must see that mom and dad reverence God in our life, that we spend lots and lots of time learning about him so that we can then put what we learn into practice. They need to see firsthand that the kingdom is important to us. It's the most important thing in our life when you stack that up against everything else that this world has to offer. They need to see that the Bible is special in our life, that Christ is special in our life. They need to see this. They need to hear us talk about it, and then they need to see us living it. They need to see that the ecclesia is special in our life. That's something we support. That's something, yes, we have trouble with from time to time, but it doesn't mean we don't go. We work through our issues because it's important to us. That uncle or that aunt, we want to spend time with them. We want to get over to their house. We want to have them come over to our house because these are important, special relationships. They need to see that we love by putting the needs of others before our own. Well, if we didn't have to pick them up today, couldn't we go do this or that? Or couldn't we maybe go here? Why do we have to go take care of this person when if we didn't have to, then we could do this ourselves? And they need to see that's not how mom and dad live. That's not how mom and dad think. That's not how mom and dad love. And when they can see the reality of the truth being lived in our lives, then you see it brings validity to God's word. Then God isn't just somebody we talk about. The Bible isn't something we read. It's something we live. And they need to see that prayer is special. It's a time when we thank God and seek his help. We admit our mistakes. And they need to see that sharing the truth with others is special. So these are the life lessons that we can reinforce for them. And if they're not seeing it in our life, it really doesn't matter how much we're talking about it in terms of principles or concepts. Because when our children see that we're living the truth, then the truth becomes alive for them. All the principles, all the commandments, all the verses they learn, all the verses they're asked to memorize, all of that means very little if mom and dad aren't living the truth. But when mom and dad are living the truth, then those memorized verses have meaning. Then the Bible readings have meaning, as do the classes and everything else. Once again, we can see the wisdom of God in designing the family unit. Because God knows that the only way for a child to grow up and learn to love him and to be part of his future is if the child sees mom and dad are genuinely committed to that way of life. So you see, our children become a motivator for right conduct by the parents. And our children become a motivator for restraining from wrong conduct for the parents. You see God's wisdom? You know, you ask the question, who's saving whom? Is it the parents saving the children by what they teach them? Or is it the children helping to save the parents? Because mom and dad know we have to stay on the straight and narrow way for the sake of the kids. It's a marvelous, marvelous relationship that God has designed. Everyone helping to save each other. And again, if we will comply with it and cooperate with it, then God is able to save us all. And it's, you know, true even when the kids are very young. We don't have to wait until they're teens before we start living the truth, because they will see through it if we're not. The flip side to this is also a sober warning, because as parents, if we're not living the truth, if we're not modeling for our children, then we are severely damaging our children, severely damaging our children spiritually. Because we leave them confused. They see mom and dad going in one direction even though they're saying something else. And all this talk about how God is important and how the Bible is important and Jesus is important, it's all just talk. And remember, brothers and sisters, we live in a very confusing world for the young people. Very confusing. How come we are the only ones that do this, mom and dad? How come nobody else? How come we don't go to those things and go to those things? And very confusing word. They need to see two things clearly in this age of confusion. One is what the truth is, what God's principles are, the principles we strive to live by. But they also need to see that mom and dad are sincere in trying to live by those principles. So that if the kingdom is just one of many objectives that mom and dad have in their life, then it's going to leave the children very incapable, really, of distinguishing between what's true and what isn't. So we come to Psalm 127, the one we had read, if you'll turn there for just a minute. We've used this term a couple of times, that our children are really God's children, and they are. This is how God views them. That's how he sees our children. He gives to us his children for 15 to 20 years as an ideal environment for his children to learn his ways, so that when they grow up, they can then embrace him as their father, and then he takes over the fatherhood, so to speak. But he relies upon us as parents to fill in that gap of the first 20 years. Verse 1 of Psalm 127, except Yahweh build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except Yahweh keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain. Verse 3, lo, children are an heritage of Yahweh, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. These are his children. We've given you a couple other references. One is in Ezekiel 16. We won't take the time to look at, but he speaks of the fact that Israel took his children and abused his children, and it cost them spiritually. The house here in Psalm 127, verse 1, isn't the physical structure It's the family unit. Same way, you know, in the ecclesia, we talk about the ecclesia. It's not the building. It's the people within the building. Look at the context. You know, the verses are dealing with people. They're not dealing with the buildings, which is why in verse 3, for instance, it talks about the children. God has got his focus here on people, on children here, not buildings. So in verse 1, it could read, except Yahweh build the family, they labor in vain that build it. You notice also in verse 1, it says, it speaks of the city. You know, except Yahweh keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. He's not talking about the walls of the city unless God keeps the walls up. He's talking about unless God keeps the people of the city safe. So it's the people that is being emphasized. The family God is building in our home doesn't belong to us. It belongs to God. And that's why he says we need to use his principles to raise our children. Because if we are not using his principles to raise our children, then God is not building our home. He's not building our family. We are using some other principles to raise our children. And he says, if that's the case, it's fruitless. It's all done in vain. It doesn't matter how many times you get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. It doesn't matter how much work you do for the kids. If we're not using God's principles and raising his children, all of our efforts, verse 1 says, all of them will be in vain. Unless he is at the center and the foundation of all that we do. Verse 3 says that children are an heritage of Yahweh. The word heritage means something inherited, something that's precious, of great value, that's passed on from one generation to the next, which shows that our children didn't originate with us. You know, again, take that concept that the world has ingrained in the minds of so many people, that we are the ones that bring our children into the world. I realize there is a physical aspect of that, but these are God's children that he is using to open the wombs of our mothers to bring his children into the world so that they will be put in a world in which he is at the center of that home and he can build that home and he can develop that godly seed. But he needs the parents to cooperate with this process. He's given his children to us for a reason. They are not something that we have created ourselves. And that's why our children, our kids, are likened to this precious heritage from God. And he wants us to regard them as a precious heritage, a spiritual heritage, not something materialistic that we inherit, but something that is spiritual and something that he has given to us. But because they are inherited, it means God has given them to us. And you'll see that in tomorrow morning's Sunday school class, God willing, where Hannah recognized this principle that Samuel had been given to her by God. Samuel and Elkanah didn't create Samuel all by themselves. That principle was clear in her mind. And Samuel is not one in a million children that just he happened to be given to that wife or that mother by God, but all the rest of God's children just happened by chance. They are all given to us as an inheritance. And you notice, too, their reward, as verse 3 says, which reinforces the fact that they are something that are given to us. They're not something that we create all by ourselves. And using that word reward, which means compensation or benefit, God says, look, I want you to see your children as a reward that I am giving to you. This isn't something that you came up with on your own. Children are not something that we work to receive. They are given to us independent of our own deeds. So we don't want to make the mistake of thinking, well, the children that have been given to me are my reward for being a good parent. Nothing God ever gives us have we earned. Nothing. So we shouldn't make the mistake to turn around and think, well, maybe our children is an exception to that. When it says they are a reward, and you notice they are his reward, what God is telling us, and I didn't get Crystal's approval on the front end, But when Kara was born into this world, she was God's gift to Nathan and Crystal. His reward. Not because they're great parents, because this is an inheritance. God says, I'm giving Kara to you, God willing, to raise Kara in your home using my principles so that she can grow up to learn to love me and my principles and embrace me as her father. That's why God gives us his children. That's what we as parents should preoccupy ourselves with. Not all the myriad of things that the world would have us chase. Now, just so we're clear, this doesn't mean we sit down with kids and strap them to the chair and force them to read the Bible. That's not what parenting is all about. We develop relationships with them. We see that you can enjoy a life in the truth, that righteousness is better than unrighteousness. So that isn't to negate all of the love and the affection and the relationships that we need to develop with our children. But it all should be done within the context of recognizing that God has given his children to us for a period of time for us to fulfill a responsibility that he has given to us as parents. His inheritance that he gives to us to raise his children in a godly home such that they will grow up to love and obey him. So, our main objective as parents should be to raise God's children with his understanding, with his ways, and to love his commandments. The children, you'll notice, are also called arrows in verse 4. And I think it's helpful to recognize God uses this metaphor of arrows, which simply in my mind means the children need to be aimed before they're let go. No child knows how to aim him or herself. They need to be aimed in the right direction, having learned of God's ways and God's principles in that godly home that God was building because he was at the center of that home. And then when they're released from the home, they're heading in the right direction. So aim them appropriately, God says, because they are like arrows. I don't want to get too far into this this next principle, but I think it's fairly important, only because the world would say this is foolishness. But conception is under God's control and guidance. The world is so smart today that they would have parents convinced that that's not the case. But that's not how God views the situation. Our children are the result of God intervening to give life to his children, children that he knows by name. Our children are not born by time and chance. The world may have all kinds of influences and factors that affect them by time and chance, but not God's children. He foreknew our children, Romans 8, verse 29 says. He predestined them to be conformed to the image of his son. He called them, he justified them so that one day he can glorify them. And I realize Romans 8 is talking about the saints at Rome. It applies to all disciples. But as we saw with the young people last night, you wouldn't say that our children the day before they're baptized, verses 28 and 29 don't apply, or 29 and 30 don't apply to them, but then the day after they're baptized, it does apply to them. God has been involved in the lives of our children from the beginning. I don't think we'll have the time to go through it, but we've given you the references. Just turn back to Genesis 30. You see, the forefathers understood this principle. And you'll see it in the language. They understood this, I think in some cases, better than we do. Our children are not born by the product of human strength. God opens and closes wombs. So you see in Genesis 30, verses 1 to 2, where Rachel would dearly love to have a child. and she bore no children. She envied her sister in verse 1 of Genesis 30 and said unto Jacob, give me children or else I die. And Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, am I in God's stead? Who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb? See, he rightly understood. Conception doesn't come because of my strength. God grants conception to his children. Rachel then, in verse 14, seeks Reuben's mandrakes. You know, these one brother has called them these love apples, thinking that somehow that will help conception. It's all hocus pocus because it doesn't do a thing. Leah will have two more sons and a daughter before Rachel will bear a child. Eventually, in verse 17, Leah knows where children come from. She knows that God must be involved. She recognized God's role, that he grants conception, because she says in verse 17, and God hearkened unto Leah, and she conceived and bare Jacob the fifth son. So it was clear in Leah's mind, it was clear in Jacob's mind. And finally, in verse 22, Rachel prays to God, no longer relying on mandrakes or anything else, and God grants conception. In verse 22, he opened her womb, and she conceived and bare a son, and said, God hath taken away my reproach. And she called his name Joseph and said, Yahweh shall add to me another son. So she prays, God hears, God hearkens, and God grants conception. And then she calls the son Joseph because she is attributing it to God. The name Joseph meaning God will grant more, or Yahweh shall add. So Rachel, by verse 24, now is recognizing God is 100% responsible for this situation. But the key point that we don't want to lose in all of this is it's important that we recognize how it's God who grants us our children. You know, he doesn't want us to see them as strictly our children. He wants us to recognize that they are his children that he has given to us for a period of time. If we end up thinking that it was all in our strength and our wisdom and our smarts and our planning and everything else from whence come our children, then we miss a big piece, and we fail to realize that these children actually belong to God and they've been given to us for our care. The final point in this first class is to appreciate the special role that mothers play in the family unit. And this can only come from my own perspective, from having observed and seeing the Word of God. But mothers do. They play, as we know, a very, very special role in the lives of their children, especially when the children are very young. So we have a quote from the Swanwick Gathering from several years back in the notes. It is impossible to overestimate the importance of the mother's influence on her children, the ability to instruct through the everyday pattern of daily life, is a mother's highest quality. From the mother's example, good or evil, children learn the rudiments of life. And the mother who redeems the time sees in all parts of her activities the need to honor the name of God, has the happy disposition of one who leaves the affairs of an unknown future in the hands of her God and concentrates instead on today and how she can please him. That such a woman, such a mother, will communicate this devotion to her children. You see, it's the mother who typically creates the godly influence or the godly environment within the home, especially when the children are young, because dad typically is away from the home for much of the time of the day. But it's the mom who sets that environment. And those well-known verses in Deuteronomy 6, though they emphasize the need to read God's word, and we don't want to diminish that at all, really what those verses are saying is this is the banner under which mothers should establish their home environment. God should be a part of her conversation with the children. God should be a part of what she's teaching the children, whether they're at the supermarket or they're at the library or they're doing laundry or whatever they're doing. God needs to be included in those discussions. Not that we are teaching them the Bible at every minute, but they can see in mom's cheery song that she sings. She's singing about God. She's not singing about something that came over the radio or something that might be popular in the world today. And when she's talking on the phone to somebody the child doesn't even know, she's using the right language and she's got a cheery voice and she's trying to encourage the other person. And even in her times of despair, she doesn't allow herself to be so cast down that she, becomes discouraged. So these verses show that the truth really needs to be for our children a way of life that they see. And mothers typically have ample daily opportunities to teach this way of life to their children. And that's why mom has such a major impact on the child's development and how she operates the household. It also underscores how important it is for the mother to be sound spiritually. Because, you can't establish a sound, God-centered home unless the mom is God-centered and sound spiritually herself. She really becomes the fulfillment of Psalm 127, verses 1, 2, and 3. For the first, 8 to 10 years of the life of her children, she has the principal responsibility to make sure Psalm 127 comes to pass. I'm not saying the husbands don't, but it's the mom who established this God-centered home, this God-centered environment in terms of her characteristics and how she acts among the children. And it's oftentimes the mother who has a special sensitivity to the spiritual needs of the kids. And again, fathers and husbands, we need to be receptive to that special sensitivity. And we need to remember God created the mother not just to have maternal instincts. He did, but they also have spiritually maternal instincts and can know spiritually, intuitively, what is good and what is not good for the children. And we need to listen to that counsel because God has given them that gift, if that's what you want to call it. So the mother's influence is obvious. Her children observe and learn by how she acts and what she says. Even at the earliest of ages, does she fret over her troubles or does she speak of her faith in God? Does she gossip about others or does she remain discreet in what she learns? Does she complain and murmur or is she content with what God has given her in life? Do the children hear her talking about the ecclesia in a negative way or in a positive way? All these things the children are observing, does she hold grudges or does she forgive? And they watch us, especially the moms. They hear the words, and they can evaluate. And that's why the mother's influence, is enormous. And it can't be a spiritually, artificially created influence. It has to be genuine. And again, we come back to the wisdom of God. So here is a mother with this little bundle of joy that has come into her life, that is now consuming so much of her life. And that little bundle of joy begins to grow and to observe, and to question, now, Mom, why do you do that? And why don't you do that? And why did you say those words? And the child begins to make judgments on just how committed Mom is to God's ways. And this little child becomes a daily reminder to her mother or his mother about just how important it is for Mom to be doing the right thing. This little bundle of joy. Because when they begin at the age of 1, 2, 3, whenever it is, to question and observe. Parenting also has humorous times. Mother of a 3-year-old does something wrong, or something goes bad, or she gets a bad phone call, or whatever. She's just a moment of weakness, and she kicks the garbage can, or she slams down the phone. I guess you don't slam phones down anymore. You just turn it off real strongly, whatever it is, and there's the 3-year-old, and then the mother sits down with the 3-year-old, and she starts apologizing to the 3-year-old and saying, well, mom made a mistake. And then she says, wait a minute, what am I apologizing to a 3-year-old for? But she should, because it's the right thing to do, because the 3-year-old has observed behavior that is not Christ-like. And the mother knows this. And so now she has to sit down with a 3-year-old and correct this situation. And it's marvelous. God has a mother apologizing to a 3-year-old because both the mother and the 3-year-old are important to God. And he wants them both in the kingdom. And again, we ask the question, who is saving whom? And God says, if you do what I have outlined, if you follow the model that I have provided, and you can see the wisdom and embrace it and cooperate with it, I can save you all. And to his honor and glory, we're all humbled, and we're all so thankful that his principles are at work in our home, that mom and dad dedicate themselves to teaching the children those principles so that the children can grow up to embrace those principles, and we can all share that that glorious future together. There's a quote in the notes, again, from Brother Tennant. We'll just leave it for your own consideration, but I thought he did a very good job of capturing what the responsibility of the mothers are and the benefit to all involved when they can fulfill that responsibility.